We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
This is In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time. And welcome to the podcast. Many of you have never experienced this before, so I just wanted all of you to relax and feel the joy. I'm about to talk to you about injuries. Injuries to the New Orleans Pelicans, something we've never spoken of before. Michael, are you appalled, horrified at this news? Like, it's surprising, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of downside, but the upside is In the Know is now brought to you by WebMD. We have our first sponsor.
No, we
don't. They actually sought us out.
It wouldn't be surprising. Holy cow.
I've gone to that site. I'm trying to think, like, there was at one point when I had my kidney stone, I didn't know what was going on, so I was checking all the symptoms there. I would say the other 78 times I've gone to WebMD, it has been Pelican-centric.
And probably in the last 2 years, right?
No, dating back to, like, 2009, I mean...
Hey, just so yeah, it was just knee.
Yeah, yeah, I wish I had known about it with Jamal Mashburn's vertigo. Something, the only other person I know that has vertigo is my 68-year-old mom, so that was a normal way for our star small forward to end his career.
That's so completely bizarre, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, I don't know how many people on this podcast were fans back when they were the Charlotte Hornets, but that was a better team than any team New Orleans has ever put together outside of the 2007-2008 season. And their starting shooting guard died in a car accident on the way home from practice, and then their star small forward's career was ended because of vertigo.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't happen to anybody else.
Yeah.
So yes, I am, through your sarcasm on the end, I totally got it. Even though we can't see each other, I felt the wink, wink.
Oh.
Yes, we deal with a lot of injuries, and this week was no different.
So I just want to put it out there. Name one team that's even close to having a situation where technically their first, second, third, probably sixth best players are likely to not play in the very first game of the season.
No, I mean, the only franchise that could compete in a are we cursed contest right now? Philadelphia's got it pretty bad because it keeps happening with, like, top picks. So they're the only one that I give a little sympathy to. Anybody else, when they're one of their players, Cincinnati, or even Memphis had it real bad last season, but that's only one season.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for literally no other teams in the NBA.
I don't even feel sorry for Philly. They knew a lot of those guys had injury problems when they drafted them, and that was part of the traction, was this guy's probably not going to play this year, so we'll suck again. Like, so.
Yeah, but not with Simmons. I mean, that was just... But
that's true.
So anyway, I mean, let's get to the actual one, what we know about Anthony Davis. Twists an ankle, of course, tries to play on it, probably made it a little worse. They're talking grade 2 ankle sprain that should keep him out, you know, definitely for these last two preseason games. I would say, just based on what it sounds like, 50-50 that he plays opening night.
Yeah, I actually expect that he will play. I think they're doing that just to be safe, but then I'm a moron, and I thought Quincy Pondexter would be available to start the season. So, yeah, I mean, based on what they're saying, it's like right at the edge. So they're going to be making the call the morning of, probably, whether he's going to play that night.
And I'm sure they'll give us all the details and keep us updated. I mean, they're never vague with injuries. So we'll know well in advance. Yeah, and then Etuan Moore looks like a little bit of a heel injury, doesn't seem too serious, but then there was a bunch of weird little injuries that kept guys like Terrence Jones out of games in China.
Yeah.
You know, didn't get a whole lot of answer there, but doesn't look like as of right now anybody else is going to miss the season opener, but that's what I was saying a little bit on our last podcast is we see the guys who are out now, and we think, oh, you know, we could get by without them, but we were just assuming that nobody else was going to get hurt. And with this team, that's just a stupid assumption.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I do want to talk about those China games, though. Just because my opinion always of preseason is guys that suck in preseason are probably going to suck in the regular season. And guys who play really well in preseason, you have no idea what's going to happen in the regular season. So, is there anybody who very clearly sucked in the preseason? So we can probably expect should suck when the regular season rolls around.
I mean, I don't know if I would say this guy sucked, but he's the antithesis of what I want on this team moving forward, and that's Lance Stephenson. You know, he had little stretches. He had one stretch in one of the games where he had back-to-back threes, and he could put the ball in the hoop, but... you know, I just see nothing in the games that leads me to believe that this is the type of guy, again, when you talk about ball movement, making sure Anthony Davis is always the number one priority, etc. I haven't seen anything there from him. Langston Galloway's had his ups and downs, but I think it's going to be a little hard for the guards until they figure out some kind of rotation, but just skill set wise and the way he plays, Lance Stephenson is the guy I keep coming back to that I don't see the fit or I don't see the allure.
Yeah, but he's getting a lot of minutes. Do you think that's just Gentry trying to figure out what he has, or do you think they're actually trying to fit him into the team so that they can play him? Like how do you read that? He's got a lot of minutes.
Yeah, and I mean, Alonzo, we've talked about this before, but Alonzo G and Dante Cunningham played a ton of minutes last year. Exactly what you said, you know what you have. You have no idea with Lance, and he's a guy that's on the bubble, so you're going to give him absolute every opportunity. And the way I read it is they want him to show something bad. They want a reason to keep him. I firmly believe that. I think they know that they're going to need a spark and need offense. I mean, we could trot out all the stats and, you know, I've heard it all before, how Gentry's teams score, even with D-League type players. But if you don't have offensive-minded players, there's always going to be that stretch in a game where you go 4 or 5 minutes without a basket. And the way this team plays defense, that's going to be the stretch that you lose a game. So I think I think they want a reason to keep Lance on the team really bad, and they keep giving him chances. Personally, I haven't seen any reason to keep him, you know. But
not even over G?
So, okay, so, I mean, before I just dismiss it, I would like to hear your... Okay, I think we both would understand that Lance is a more talented player than G. Okay, that's, we know that. But make the argument, you're in the coach's room, for why you actually make the decision to keep Lance on the roster and let G go.
We desperately need a person on the second team to help handle the ball and keep the pressure off of Moore or Galloway, who are going to have to be the primary ball handlers in that situation most of the time.
Okay, and then my counter would be that, yeah, in theory he would be able to do that, but we also probably have Buddy on that second unit who are going to want to get touches, who are going to want to build his confidence, same with Ajinsa, you know, and we're going to have Lance, who's a traditionally higher usage guy, that is going to have the ball. Every time he has the ball in his hands, that's a moment Buddy doesn't have it in his hands, or Ajinsa with a higher field goal and higher efficiency, he doesn't have it in his hands, et cetera, et cetera. So, that would be my counter, is that every opportunity Lance has, you're taking it out of the hands of a guy who you see probably as a bigger long-term piece.
Right, but are you going to get anything out of G that Stevenson can't give you?
The fact that he won't have it in his hands. So, I mean, to me, that's I guess it's not something directly that you could attribute to G, but if, let's say, on 10 possessions, you know, G is only going to touch it twice and do something, finish a play with it once, versus Lance is going to touch it on 6 of those possessions and, you know, look to create or take a shot on 3 or 4 of those. Those 2 to 3 possessions that Buddy has it instead of Lance, to me, that's a positive in the G column. It's, you know, even though G's not doing anything, by not doing something, he is helping other guys out more.
So then let's jump to the next point here. So we're talking about this team needing to rebuild its basic, you know, its foundation. That's what they brought in, all these, you know, tough-minded but not high-ceiling players. Is it more helpful right now that we might lose some games, but we have Buddy in there for big minutes to figure out if he can develop into anything? Would you rather see that? Or would you rather see them go ahead and have Stevenson in there and maybe have a few more efficient minutes? You've already said you don't want Stevenson, but let's just say we can change it to Heald versus Moore. Like, if I told you that you could have Buddy in there for 30 minutes a game or Moore in there for 30 minutes a game, but not both of them, which one would you rather see playing those 30 minutes?
I mean, to me, it's Buddy. I break this season down as the first half or so of the season is about process, and then the second half we could start talking about results. And I see that with both individuals and team settings where, you know, Mason wrote a really great piece, and we're going to talk about it later on our site, but to me, I think you could put a bunch of great defensive, individual defensive players together, and they're not going to be good for some time. I mean, defense is about communication. It's about playing on a string, trusting each other. That's going to take time, even if you have good individual pieces. You know, and I see that overall with the team in its entirety. I think that the first half is going to be all about building a process. And to me, I think Lance, you might be able to steal a game or two that you won't with G, but at what cost? It's going to be at putting Buddy in a role, putting Frazier or Galloway in a role that they're not going to be in later down the line. I say just put the guys in the role that they're going to be in when everybody's healthy, And even though, you know, they're not going to have the pure talent to win games, so what? Just live with it. And then eventually Pondexter comes back and he replaces G, and you're a little bit better. And then eventually Holiday comes back and, you know, he replaces Frazier and your defense is a little bit better. I just think the first half of the season's all going to be about process, and I wouldn't ruin that with a guy like Lance, even if it gets me an extra win or two.
Okay. Yeah, Buddy, like, I've really liked seeing what he's been doing in the preseason, and this is kind of what you want to see with a rookie. Like, I know people are still... I want to have one pet peeve. I was listening to a podcast because I'm absorbing every single possible podcast in the world coming up on the season, and somebody, I can't remember who it was, I think it was on the one of the CBS podcasts, and anyways, they actually referred to Buddy as, well, he's already 22, he's as old as Anthony Davis, he pretty much is what he is going to be. And I just wanted to smack that guy. I'm sorry. Like, I fall into the same trap everybody else who falls, like, watches the draft is like, that guy's only 19. His ceiling's way higher than Buddy Hield, who had a little bit better of a season, but you know, he's 22 and he's going to be 23 soon. Like, NBA players actually peak when they're 25. You know who came into the NBA at age 22? Tim Duncan. Did he suck because he came in at 22? Like, I'm sorry. I don't think Buddy's going to be a surefire all-star every single year, but to pretend that because he's 22, he's not going to change from what you saw last year is absolutely ridiculous. So, that's my little
question. Well, I'm mad that you were so specific and pointed out the podcast. You should have just said everybody's saying he's...
everybody's saying this, right?
Yeah. No, it's a frustrating thing because... It's hard. People don't give specifics as much as anymore. It's, you know, people who are 19 years old have upside, and people who are 22, you know, are what they are, when in reality, it's all across the board, all different spectrums, you know, depending on different players. There's guys who are 19 right now who will never get any better or just, you know, aren't going to be much better than what they are now, and then obviously guys who come in later who continue. I mean, Steph Curry, when he came into the league, I firmly remember people thought it was crazy that he would play point guard. He was an undersized shooting guard, and that was that. He'd never be able to play point guard in the NBA, you know, and he picked it up. But the other side I want to hedge people against is, on the, you know, I hear people say, well, Buddy Hield, he has an amazing work ethic, so that's why he's going to be a little bit different or the outlier to that or why he's going to keep improving. I know people don't want to believe it, but Austin Rivers really did have an amazing work. I went to Summer League and saw him every day being the last guy shooting free throws, and he was making them in practice and work, and I mean, he would never stop. He was taking a ton of threes. He was working on his hitch, all of that stuff. Like, Tony Allen has been trying to develop a jumper for 12 years. Like, just because a guy wants to be really good and works hard at something, that isn't always going to work either. So I just would say that people just let it happen. Why do we have to, every game, project his future based off of that? Let's just watch him play, enjoy the fact that we have a guy on the team who seems to love basketball and wants to play for the city of the team we root for, and I don't understand why we have to project a guy's NBA career after every game, whether it's a summer league game, preseason game, in China, on the West Coast. Like, just let the guy play. Sorry. Now, that was my rant on top of your rant.
Yeah. So ranting. We want to see Buddy.
Let him play. Hashtag Bad News Bears 2.
Well, I mean, I do have to say that at one point you told me that you weren't certain how much of the season you were going to watch. And my response right away was, I can't miss Buddy. Like, I'm sorry. Rookies are exciting to me. Like, you would, back when Chris Paul was on this team, I remember distinctly thinking, I'm excited for the season, not just because Chris Paul's on the team. I was super excited to see Julian Wright play. That guy, I was just waiting for, I could not wait to see the 6'9" small forward of the future who is just going to carry this team to the top. Like, that's the kind of, you know, feeling I have for rookies who have high expectations. And for this team, I've had them dashed quite a lot. But, yeah, it's still, it's exciting to have, like, a guard who looks like he has unlimited range and could become something. So, that'd be fun to watch him.
Yeah, in theory it is. And then they're down 18 points in a game, and he's chucking, and, you know, it is what it is.
Like, how long did Marcus Thornton and Darren Collison were fun to watch their rookie season.
I think we remember the games that they were fun to watch, yeah. You know. Reality, I mean, I remember, I could tell you the first game that Emeka Okafor played in for us because thought the same thing. It was again, huh?
4 blocks, I believe he had.
Oh, I don't even remember this. I remember it was against the San Antonio Spurs, and we got absolutely destroyed. But he showed a little baby hook from the baseline, and I was like, well, that's more creating offense for himself than Tyson Chandler ever gave us. Yeah, we got beat by 30 tonight, but this team's going to be better with Okafor than Chandler. You know, you always talk yourself into some optimistic outlook or whatever, but I'm just going to enjoy the games as they go. I don't have to worry about projecting the next 15 years today. No, I don't have a spreadsheet due.
So you don't hear the funniest thing, though, about Okafor? Do you remember when he was switching sides, he would run down the court, and halfway down the court, he would turn his upper torso 180 degrees and then turn his rest of the body afterwards, kind of like a robot, like, turning around? And the first time I saw him do that, I'm like, wow, he's really robotic. And robotic has such a bad connotation to NBA players. I immediately said, no, don't think that. And, like, from that point on, every time he did that, I cringed. I should have, like, obeyed my instincts with that as soon as I saw that. Like,
yeah, we would obey our instincts if he was a player on our least favorite team.
That's true. We'd be mocking him mercilessly, kind of like we sort of are now. But
So we talked about guys who might have played bad. How about good? How much? I know you say you don't read too much into it, but we have seen a slightly different Omer Asik in the preseason, both in the stat columns and, you know, eye test. I think we've seen a slightly different guy, at least from what we saw last year. Any optimism? Any renewed expectations for Omer this season based off what you've seen so far?
So I am more willing to believe he can bounce back closer to what he used to be than I was. In a lot of respects, I was just hoping he wouldn't be utter garbage. But it's possible he could go back to being a decent defensive player and a terrible offensive player that basically balances itself out or is almost just a little bit worse than a net negative in the net positive in the end. I think that's possible. Last year, he was utter garbage, so that's an improvement. Ajinsa, he's been kind of utter garbage. So we kind of need us. Although, you got to talk about matchups, too. Like, is there a worse matchup in the league than Ajinsa trying to score against the Houston Rockets?
Not many.
I mean, Asik, you can at least sit there and say, he can battle Capella. He can crash the offensive glass really hard. There are things that he's good at that he can do against the Rockets, and the Rockets don't really have a great counter for. Ajinsa is try to create space and float in the mid-range and not play with a lot of force around the rim. But the Rockets can counter that. They're not going to have too much trouble making Ajinsa's life miserable. So I think that's part of the issue, too, is just the team we are watching. But, you know, it's promising to see Asik actually out there. And as Justin Verrier said, like, I watched a couple interviews of Asik, and he does have, like, almost an endearing hangdog way of speaking about last year and how bad he was. It's, you're just kind of like, aw, you feel bad.
Yeah, I agree. Can't be much worse. I mean, he's not, I think people need to throw out the window the chance of him ever getting rid of his terrible qualities.
Yeah.
When we say he's going to be better, that doesn't mean he's going to catch the ball. He's never going to be able to catch the ball in traffic. He's always going to have bad hand. And, like, I think people find stuff like that so frustrating because it's something that they can do, or at least they think they can do. So every player in the NBA has things that they're not good at, but we don't completely get upset with, let's say, Dante Cunningham for not having a great three-point shot, because not many of us could go out there and shoot 39% from three. So we're a little bit more forgiving of that. But all of us think that we could catch a basketball, you know, certainly at a higher rate than Omer. So I think that is why we don't forgive his weakness as much as we do other weaknesses that are just as bad for a team. But he's never going to change that, or just like other guys are never going to fix their deficiency. I think people think he could just go out there and practice catching, but no, Tony Allen could go out there and practice shooting for the next 10 years. He's never going to be a good shooter. Omer is never going to be good at catching the ball. Just deal with it. But there's still other ways that he could be an effective NBA player, even though he has that glaring weakness.
Yeah. I also need to say, Shake Diallo, 12.7 rebounds in 20 minutes, and he had the third best plus minus on the team in that game.
Like, you mean after the Rockets already had a 40-point lead and came in and got some garbage?
Stop it! We're talking about, like, if you project that out to 36 minutes a game, he's like going to be that 20-12 guy. It's going to happen.
I found it really interesting that both in Summer League and now these preseason games, I don't know if he's got the green light or if he's just taking mid-range jumpers. Like,
he can't make them.
I really wonder if they're like, look, we know you're not good at it now, but as we project you into year three, we want you to have that in your tool belt, so just fire away in the preseason and summer league, or if he's just taking it upon himself.
I don't know. I think they're pretty much saying go in there and stretch yourself and show us what you can do, because when he's been going in, it's either summer league, which is garbage, or it's garbage time. So they're just letting him do what he thinks he needs to. I really do think that. And like, what's the harm, really? Like, I was watching a preseason game on the background while I was playing a video game, and it was Toronto, and Bismack Biyombo took a 15-foot jumper. Like, that guy, I think he missed everything. Like, backboard, rim, everything, kind of wide left kind of thing. Like, there's no way he's taking that in a real game. So let him stretch himself and feel good about himself for a little bit before you actually hit the real games.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic. Like I said, nothing fantastic, but if you look at what Omer did the second half of that playoff year, obviously before we got to Golden State, he was a huge reason the Pelicans snuck into the playoffs that year. If they could give him anything close to that, that's a huge plus. But on the other end, Ajinsa hasn't looked very good. I don't know how to best utilize Ajinsa. Like, you would think that he would be a good second unit scorer, but he doesn't score in the traditional ways a 7-footer scores. He's still so dependent, and he seems to play much better with Anthony Davis just because of the space that gives him. I don't know if he could just kind of score on his own. He's more of a product. He's one of those guys that just he plays better with better players around him, and he can't really elevate his game when the attention isn't on everybody else. So you don't want to start him if he didn't deserve it, but I don't know if he could provide anything as a second unit player, so I really don't know what to do with him.
Well, I'll be honest, if Tim Frazier was our backup point guard, I think we would be in a much better situation with Ajinsa. If we have an actual pick and roll shot creator, or in Ajinsa's case, pick and pop, I think that helps him a lot. But we don't have that, and we're not going to have that until Drew comes back. So I think Frazier in the right situations with a Jensen is okay. But right now, if you're expecting to post up a Jensen and get any points out of him, you're looking for fool's gold.
Yeah, like, can you imagine a second unit of Frazier, Galloway, Heald, Terrence Jones, and Ajinsa?
Yeah.
That wouldn't be a bad one. You have 4-5 good passers on there. Everybody could shoot a little bit. Some could shoot a lot. I think a lineup like that would be pretty interesting for Ajinsa. But last thing is just, I mean, with this Davis injury, let's say, yeah, he's back game one. Gentry's been saying for a while that he really wanted to get his rotations in place these last two preseason games. Even if Anthony Davis is 100% on the first game, do you see any downside to him missing this last week?
Absolutely. Because right, what is he going to do? You want to start getting the guys a little comfortable with each other. And having 24 minutes in a game to actually play next to each other, because that's kind of what they do, is they just rotate those units out. 24 minutes for half the game, these guys are playing together, they're starting to maybe figure out what works, and have at least like 5 or 6 plays you know will probably have a chance of working when you line up against the Denver Nuggets on opening night. And it's not going to happen. And you know, the worst part about this too is, the Denver Nuggets game is probably their best chance at a win in the first 4 games. It's now a real possibility they start the season 0-4 or 0-5. It's terrible.
Yeah, it's kind of a repeat where, you know, I know it seems like everybody was just out at the beginning of last season, but it was actually a trickle thing where, you know, we didn't fully know about Pondexter, then Ajinsa got hurt, then Omir, and then, oh no, Tyreek's not going to be able to play. Oh, Norris Cole got hurt too. And then by the time, you know, none of them individually looked terrible because Anthony Davis was still there. Drew was going to play, just not on back-to-back. So, like, as when Norris Cole gets injured, you're like, yeah, we could still make it. But then you look, and they had all compiled, and it's starting to feel the same way this year, where, you know, if Davis misses, compiled with everything else, I agree. I think it could be just as ugly of a start as last year. I mean, there's some winnable games in there, but there's no gimmies, and frankly, even with Davis on the team, but with Drew and Tyreek and Quincy gone, how many teams in the league do you think that we go into a game, obviously at home, and say, all right, that's a game that I expect to win 80% of the time?
I could probably, 5 would probably be my number.
So Philly, Brooklyn. Lakers?
Yeah. That's what the Lakers probably.
I wouldn't put Sacramento on there.
I wouldn't, because we see how they play Sacramento every year. I would probably say the Suns. I think they're going to be playing more youth this season, then it's going to hurt them a little bit.
I agree once they get there, but beginning of the season, let's say Booker and Bledsoe are healthy against our defense. I don't know.
Yeah.
I would give that a 55-60% win probability in my book.
Okay. Yeah, I can't think of any other 80% winners.
And that's what I'm saying. It's like you're such on a razor's edge right now.
Yeah, it's a tipping point.
Give us the first game and rest them the next. You ain't winning the next two anyway.
Well, we wanted them to do that last year with injuries and stuff like that, and didn't have, like, don't play Drew in the first game. And it didn't work. They didn't do it. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I just, you know, I want to sit here and say this team has a real shot at the playoffs. And my heart of hearts, I don't think they do anymore because of all the injuries. But I just want to see how this foundation actually works together. Because if they start playing these games and they can't get the defense rolling, and this kind of harks back to what Mason Ginsberg was saying in his piece which if you guys haven't seen it, it's on the site. It's really nice. It's a post called Quick Wins and a Path Forward. And it just kind of talks about the team and trying to figure out, you know, what we have and what they should be focusing on. Like, if this team comes out in the first month of the season, even without Drew, they're an abysmal defensive team. Like, that's just an utter failure. There's no question. Like, even if they tighten up and get a little bit better, if they're terrible to start off the season, and granted, they do have Golden State and San Antonio right at the very beginning, which will screw up their numbers to begin with, but we'll watch the games. We can use our eyeballs. We'll know if this team is terrible defensively. Then that's just the most depressing thing in the world to me. That means that they reset all their expectations of what they're trying to do, and they'll end up with another failure on their hands.
And so you're only giving them a month before you make that judgment?
I'm giving them a month to see if they have anything going. Yeah. Like, I'm not going to sit there and say if they have, like, the 18th ranked defense or the 22nd ranked defense, I'm going to smash them. If I'm watching and Solomon Hill works really well with Davis, or, like, they have some guys who work off of each other well defensively, I'm not going to trash them. But if they're just a disaster, like, every year we watch this team, they're a disaster the last 5 years defensively. If they're like that, if you watch guys just waltz to the rim for layup after layup, then I'm done.
Yeah, I don't know. See, to me, it's what's so interesting is that the difference between great and bad in sports, I think, is much smaller than sometimes we talk about. So, like, the one I always give for this is Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods was far and away the best golfer in the world and probably the best golfer of all time. As far as when he was at his peak, no golfer in history had ever seen a peak like that. Then all of a sudden he has all the problems, and then, you know, I think now he's ranked like 1,000 something in the world, but even before that, every single PTI started with, what's wrong with Tiger? Does he need to change his swing? What had really happened was his average score had gone from like 69.2 to 70.8, like less than 2 strokes per round. And that's one extra putt per 9 holes that instead of going in, rimmed out. That was the difference between being the greatest of all time and just another average guy who won a couple tournaments of what was wrong with them. And it's the same in basketball. If you look at a normal team takes about, what, 80 shots per game or so in or around that area.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a great defense, they made 32. If they made 36, you're probably a slightly below average defense. That's one shot per quarter that, you know, your contest was a half a second late and the guy made instead of missed. One shot per quarter made versus missed is the difference between an elite, possibly historic defense and a below average one. I think that the margin is so small, and we're talking about a collection of guys who are playing together essentially in most cases for the first time. I think even if the scheme is good and even if they're all above average defenders, it takes time. And I just, to me, I won't even start to begin my judgment until probably mid-January. And if they're 27th in the league in January, but they've been 12th over the last month, to me, they're on the right track. I'm going to give them time.
Okay.
I mean, who do you think would be better tomorrow? A group of, let's say, A-minus defenders that hadn't played together, or a group of B-minus defenders who have been playing together the last 2 years? Who do you think would play better defense in a game tomorrow?
Probably the B-minus group.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. So I just think it takes
We're talking a month later, like, so 12 games later, 14 games later, which of those two teams is going to be nastier on defense?
I think it would be pretty close. I would still say the B minus, but it would be very close. But the point that it would ever be close shows that time is as big of a factor, if not bigger, than I mean, I don't think there's really much individual defense played in the NBA anymore. I look at the Spurs. Like, they brought in LaMarcus Aldridge last year. They had a 57-year-old Tim Duncan, and they still had one of the best defenses of all time. And it's, yeah.
Aldridge isn't bad. Aldridge's never been a bad defender.
He's never been a good one.
Well, he's been all right.
The defense was it. But those guys, they trust each other. I mean, the Spurs, the reason why they're so good is they trust each other. I mean, go play a pickup game and watch a guy continually get burned. All of a sudden, you'll start over-helping. Everybody starts over-helping and kick-out options are wide open. The reason the Spurs are so good is because they trust each other. They never over-help. They communicate. Like, that takes some time. So, I don't know. I just want to see trends, but I agree. I really liked Mason's piece. I don't think that you put five good defenders on the court and all of a sudden a good defense make. Carlos Boozer, the Bulls with Carlos Boozer were very good defensive teams, and Boozer sucked. Like, it's not necessarily individual offenders. It's, do your guys talk? Do they communicate? And do they trust each other? And I think that takes time, even if you have good individual pieces.
All right. And let me make a segue off of that, because one of the things we keep hearing about Anthony Davis, and this is the same kind of crap you hear every preseason, but maybe it's true, maybe it's not. We can't tell if that's true or not, but when somebody comes to you and says, Anthony Davis has a different demeanor this year, he's more of a leader, he's going to talk more on defense, do you, like, buy into that right away? Do you think there's a chance that that's actually going to happen? Or do you think he's probably just the same dude he was last year, where he's not that vocal of a leader?
No, I think that stuff happens, but when it's not innate, I don't know if it continues to happen when the going gets rough. Like, I think Kevin Garnett, it's in his blood, his DNA. When if his team is 30-5, or if they're 5-30, he is going to talk. He's going to get in everyone's face. He's going to be that guy. With Anthony Davis, I think when things are going well, when he's reminded, you know, he'll be that guy. But then when things aren't going so well and he starts getting chippy, and when he says something and some guy snaps back that he knows, and, you know, he doesn't need to keep hearing it from him, you know, Garnett at that point will get in your face more and make you cry. Anthony Davis might back up. So I believe everybody wants to do all this stuff. And I think it's the same way. Like, let's you and I go to one of those self-help, you know, seminars this weekend. We'll leave there all pumped up, saying all the right things, the 8 keys to success, and we're going to start doing them. Flash forward to 3 weeks later, we ain't doing them. Like,
I'm doing them.
Oh, you still are?
I'm doing, like, I don't know what your problem is.
What's key number five? What's rule five?
All right, then I'm done.
No, I think everybody wants to do that, but if it's not innate, I just don't think that it sticks. I think it sticks if things start going well, and then he'll have a false correlation of they're going well because I'm doing this, and then he'll switch it.
Right.
But if things are going poor, he'll think, well, this thing doesn't help, so, you know, you won't stick with it. So if we could create that false correlation and then have this team win some unexpected games this year, I think it might stick.
So then let me ask you my follow-up to that. Because I don't honestly believe that Anthony Davis is ever going to be like a major vocal leader for this team. Maybe he will be. Maybe I'll be surprised. He is 23. And it took me a long time before I had confidence wherever I was working. If look at this roster right now, I tell you there is a vocal leader somewhere on this roster. Give me the name of the person who's that leader.
I would guess Solomon Hill.
Okay.
He's obviously comfortable talking. He's very, I mean, you listen to his press conferences and he's very aware. You know, he could break down for you what part of the defensive process they're in right now. I would guess him. How about you?
That's exactly where I was going. And then I was going to say, because you know what? Nobody's talking about Solomon Hill.
No!
So what do you think about Solomon Hill so far in these games? Like, people are actually talking about him, and most of them are kind of like, well, they're not like excited. But I look at Solomon Hill's numbers, and that's kind of what I'm hoping for. As long as the defense is there, that's what I wanted. Is it different for you?
No, and I mean, to me, I don't think I'm going to judge him by the numbers as much as, can he play the four in key stretches into close games? And what I didn't like from the China games is if you watch Draymond Green when that ball hits the rim, watch the way he attacks a rebound. Solomon Hill still has the rebounding mentality of a wing or a guard, in my opinion. He just kind of watches the ball on the rim, waits for it to come to him. That was my one really big disappointment from watching Hill in these games, is I don't see that aggressive mentality that, I mean, even somebody like Harrison Barnes, when he played the four for Golden State, I just, that's what it's going to come down for me. Are we going to be able to get away with him playing the four on the defensive end at the end of games and in key moments? I think we will as far as defense. Will we as far as rebounding? And to me, that's the one area where I see that he needs to improve, just his mentality when attacking the glass.
Okay. All right. So anything about Solomon Hill? Like, I got to say, when was the last time you saw a small forward on this team over a four-game stretch average 3 assists per game?
Yeah, I think he's going to move the ball. Like I said, when Drew and Coupon get back, I think you have a lot of guys who are going to move the ball. I think he's going to be one of them. I think he's going to play good defense, and he's going to have games where he goes 3-for-4 from 3 and games where he goes 0-for-4 from 3, and you're just going to have to live with that. To me, it's part of defense. You know, I never used to think this, and it used to get me upset when Dennis Rodman won defensive player of the year. I just didn't get it, but I totally get it now, just watching this team, how big of a part of defense rebounding is, because really nothing else matters until you secure the ball. So that's going to be it for me. But you brought up Anthony Davis a little bit as far as being a leader. I've got one other question for you, and I think before we really answer it, we might have to give some definition. So the injuries keep piling up. You know, anybody who hasn't listened yet, go check out the Locked On Pelicans podcast with our own Jake Madison. It's really been good. It's putting them out every day, talking about, you know, all things Pelicans. But he has a problem with the term soft, with the term injury prone. He gave a good argument for why he thinks Anthony Davis is neither of those things. I tend to disagree. I think I would label him, relative to all other NBA players, injury prone, but I would definitely not call him soft. But as I started thinking about my reasons and why, I started realizing and reading other people's stuff that it's because people are talking across definitions again. And again, this is the reason for most of our arguments. I find that people have different definitions for each word, and that's why some call them soft, some call them injury prone, some call them neither. So I want to get from you any or all of the definitions. When people are talking about an athlete, an NBA, an NFL player, whatever, what do they usually mean? What should they mean when they say something like soft and something like injury prone? What do those two words mean to you?
So to me, soft means not only do they they use injuries as excuses not to play, but they'd also tend to back down to people while they're playing rather than deal with any sort of physical confrontation.
Okay, so the second one, yeah, that doesn't apply to injuries, but the first one, the injury-specific one, you're saying that if we're going to call somebody soft, it's because that what they're just they don't want to play through injury. They don't.
Yeah, so like soft has so many negative connotations to me. Really, like it's like so I sprained my ankle. I could probably come back and play on it at 95% after three games, but I don't want to do that because it's going to be sore afterwards. And I'm just going to take an extra couple games and let it heal up a little more. And they'll use that as an excuse not to go back on the floor, no matter who's relying on them. That's how I think of soft. And they use it as an excuse because they could play. If you can play 95% of your thing and there's not a risk that suddenly it's going to cause you to miss like a week because you played on it, it's a soft thing not to play on it that way. You know what I mean?
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate based on your definition for why you might be able to call Anthony Davis soft.
Okay.
We've seen the laundry list of injuries that he's had and the games he's missed, and, you know, Jake pointed out that he hasn't missed more than 10 games. He only has it for two different injuries, and one of them he probably could have played through, but they shut him down because the season was over.
Yep.
So really it's just a bunch of small injuries. Now, here would be maybe a very simple-minded, but there's some logic in this argument person. They would say, all right, give Kobe Bryant those same exact injuries throughout his career, same exact injuries. How many games does he play versus how often does he play through that jammed finger that Anthony Davis had or that bruised knee or whatever? What would you say to that? Just let's just say Kobe Bryant and the 22 injuries Davis has had that has made him miss anywhere between 1 and 13 games. How many of those injuries keep Kobe Bryant from playing in a game?
I would be willing to bet that Kobe Bryant would play through some of them that Anthony Davis didn't.
So if that is the case, then are we saying, I mean, where do we draw the line of Anthony Davis's quote-unquote using an injury as an excuse versus maybe Kobe Bryant is just an insane human being and he shouldn't be the threshold for whether we say whether a guy should play with X level of pain?
I think it's a little bit of both, but I'd also say that at what point in Anthony Davis's career so far do you think someone has said to him, if you don't play this game, or he even feels the pressure that if he doesn't play those games, something significant is on the table. Like, that, the game that he misses two games in a row in February, do you think at any point anyone has come to him or he's thought, if I don't play these two games, there's no chance at the playoffs? Most of his career, they haven't even been in the playoff race for most of the times he's been injured. To be honest, like they're not even close. Like 1 year, they've been in the playoff race. So if you're gonna miss the playoffs anyways, you're probably gonna win between 35 and 40 games. Does it matter if you played those two games and got 37 wins instead of 35 wins?
Okay, but if you said that, so I'm gonna tell you two players that if you said that exact sentence to, would smack you in your face. Michael Jordan believed every single game he owed it to the fans because that might be their first night and their only time seeing him live. Mm-hmm. So he went out every single game where he wasn't dying or dead. Regular season, doesn't matter. You know, and he played and gave 100% no matter what. And then Larry Bird.
Yeah.
Larry Bird, it would make him physically sick to his stomach if he had to be sitting on the bench and couldn't help his teammates. So there's maybe another kind of soft when they're just talking about a mental side of if we're going to call Kobe or Michael Jordan or Larry Bird like this alpha type of nasty, rip your heart out, love the game, do anything for it, you have to shoot him in the neck to get him to not play. if that's one side of it, then what is Anthony Davis if what you're saying is true of, well, Anthony, it's kind of your choice, you know, do what you feel is right, and he's going, well, you know, we're not going to make the playoffs any, like,
well, but you got to frame it differently, though, because what's actually happening now, and this is just, so back in 1984, when Jordan is being drafted, or when Larry Bird is playing at the peak of his capabilities, the trainers just said, you want me to tape it up, and or you want to play on it or not? It's up to you. Like, that's kind of how now trainers are told, you go to them and say, look, we want to be conservative about this. We want to make sure you're 100% ready to go. And they're actually going to put the pressure in some respects on make sure you're 100% ready too. So that's part of the conversation as well. But I will say that he's not, like, those guys you're talking about are pathological. Like, Kobe Bryant's pathological. Those guys are sick in the head.
So, okay. Yeah, and just one side note of something I just realized is I wish there were more women in or around the NBA, because you have all these voices for other guys. Like that trainer that you just did.
Yeah,
like
the gritty
really
trainer.
I want to hear you do some, like, female voices, but since you're always talking about people in or around the NBA, I only get to hear your male voices of the trainer or the owner or the coach or the, you know, the even the blogger. We just need more women in the NBA. Okay, so that's soft. I think we could rule out the soft part, or say that, okay, he's not Kobe or Michael or Larry Bird, but he's definitely in the upper 50% as far as whatever you want to call that metric. Now let's talk about injury prone. So when you hear that somebody is injury prone, what does that mean to you? How would you define that?
It just means that they get injured a lot. Eric Gordon was their injury prone.
But so they get injured a lot, or their body is, see, okay, so that's yours. Mine is that their body is more susceptible to injuries than the majority of other NBA players. So, like, if you get injured a lot, theoretically it could all be freak stuff, or, you know, but if you are injury prone, it's that, I mean, if you're prone to something, it means that you're more susceptible to something. And to me, that means that your body or maybe your playing style or a combination of the two is such that it makes you more likely to get an injury and not, you know, not be able to play with it than the average player.
Okay.
So based on my definition, I mean, I don't know, I tend to feel that way about Anthony. Like, a lot of guys hit their finger on the rim.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, you know, whatever happened, they don't get it dislocated or jammed or whatever happened to Anthony Davis where he had to miss those couple of games a couple of years ago. A lot of guys twist an ankle and, you know what, they're right back on. Like, it's hard for me to believe that. I mean, Damian Lillard's been in the league, obviously, the same number of games, number of seasons. It's just hard for me to believe that Anthony Davis has all the bad luck and Damian Lillard just doesn't run into that bad luck. It's more, it's easier for me to believe that Anthony Davis's body, as constructed, is just not willing or not able to handle it. Same with DeAndre Jordan. Like, DeAndre Jordan doesn't get hurt. He battles through, you know, every season and plays 80, 82 games. I would agree that Anthony Davis is injury prone, and based on my definition, that means that his body is more susceptible to, if you impact it in the same way as you impact DeAndre Jordan's body, Anthony Davis is more likely to get injured than DeAndre Jordan.
Yes. I agree. I think Anthony Davis injury prone. Like, let's just be honest about this. And I know no one wants to really hear this, but when you have that many different types of injuries and they're all for short duration, you take any other player in the NBA who averages the 35 minutes a game that Anthony Davis plays over that stretch, is there anybody in the NBA with that list of injuries? You won't find it. You might find a few people that are close, but those people are also probably injury prone. And you're going to find a lot of people who don't have that kind of injury history. So Anthony Davis is injury prone. There's a lot of different ways he gets banged up, and you can just for 30 seconds watch Anthony Davis on offense running and jumping. He still looks awkward. Doesn't he look a little awkward to you still? He's not a graceful dude.
Yeah, it looks awkward because I still don't know what he's trying to be. A reason why something looks awkward is because we don't see it other places. And how many other guys his size
right. Do
we see but trying to do those things?
You watch Kevin Durant. Does he look awkward at all to you? He looks smooth as hell.
Yeah, and I mean, he's clearly, you know, a wing player and been playing that way his whole life.
Right.
Denny Davis is kind of stuck in between two careers right now.
Yeah, it's not surprising to me that he's injury prone. But it sucks. If Anthony Davis plays more than 70 games this season, is that a surprise to you? To me, it would be kind of a surprise to me if he beat 70.
Yeah, I mean, it would just mean that a lot of the breaks went his way. You know, as far as...
You had to use the word break.
Things like what happened, you know, in China not have... Because, again, everything is so fickle... He doesn't twist that ankle, and, you know, so many conversations are different, and he would have still have had, 21 or 22 other injuries, but it wouldn't have been a topic on PTI. And, I mean, a guy could have not been there. I mean, there's so many ways that he doesn't twist his ankle in that game, and, yeah, it just is going to come down to the luck of the draw, but I think we're past the point. Again, if you go by my definition of injury prone, means that your body is constructed in such, you know, as a makeup in such a way that you are more likely to get injured than the average person who has that same type of impact. It would be very hard for me to buy an argument where people said he's not injury prone. So I fully buy into that now, and just because he's missing a lot of, you know, if he was only missing 2-3 games here or there and the team was really well constructed around him, yeah, it wouldn't really bother me that much. But, you know, let's say Drew was here this year. To me, the difference between Anthony Davis playing 68 games and 78 games would have probably been the difference in making the playoffs or not. So, for right now, without him having a ton of talent around him, those 2-3 game stretches really hurt. And what's also not in there are all the games where he gets injured in the first quarter the game before. So, yeah, he only misses 3 games, but he really missed 4 because he got hurt in the, you know, in that game before he missed 3.
Right.
And that happens a lot with him. So I would be hard-pressed to say that he's not injury-prone. I just don't know if there could be anything that's done about it long-term. He seemed to feel really good about himself this year and having his body in shape, feeling his core stronger, et cetera, et cetera. And he still goes out and gets hurt in basically the, you know, second game with real minutes that he was getting.
Yeah. Why you gotta be so depressing?
Well, I just want to... I'm a philosophy person, so I like to set out definitions. And just when I hear people talk about soft and injury prone, they usually argue because they haven't set the parameters and laid out the definition. Because I think most people would agree that he's not soft if you set out the right definition. But yeah, if you go and compare him to Kobe, he's going to look mentally weaker or less tough than a lunatic like that.
Yeah. But, you know, in good news, we still have Tim Frazier on the team. Tim Frazier's awesome. I'm trying to uplift people. Tim Frazier!
And Tim Frazier never gets injured, so...
He doesn't. He's a machine. No one can point to any long-term injury that Tim Frazier has had while he's been in the NBA.
So we're pretty close to the regular season. We got two preseason games left. We still got a couple of cuts to go.
Yeah.
Let's say we're sitting here next Sunday. We're 3 days away from opening night. What would you have liked to have seen or gotten out of this next week?
Other than Anthony Davis coming back and being healthy?
Yeah, let's say we, you know, next Sunday they say he's going to go in the first game. But what else would you have liked to see from these two preseason games or just in general?
I want to see a very clear lock on the idea of Frazier and Moore being the starting guards, because I think they should be. And I would like to also just see Omer Asik continue to, like, he goes up against Dwight Howard at Atlanta. So I want to see him continue to be fairly effective and not be terrible. And other than that, I tried to argue the other way sort of earlier, like Stevenson not being on the team would be a good thing. What do you think of Quinn Cook? Want him on the team? There's no room.
We had 18 roster spots, sure, but for every guy you want on the team,
yeah,
you also have to give the guy that you don't have on the team, so I can't name that guy. So, no, I guess I don't want Quinn Cook on the team.
Yeah, I mean, so the real options are letting G walk, having Cunningham cut, which will never happen because he's got guaranteed salary for more than just the season, or finding a trade for one of them or a Ginsa. That's just not happening. So, you know, like, does anybody really want us to, like, have to give up a second-round pick to move a Ginsa somewhere else or move G somewhere else just to keep Lance Stevenson? That's crazy. Like, the difference between those guys is not significant enough to matter.
Yeah, especially in a season where I don't really know if wins is the metric. I mean, right now, to me, it's just about process. So, yeah, I would say all those things. I would say the other thing I think they have a really interesting opportunity here for with Davis out is Solomon Hill getting a lot of minutes at the four.
Hmm.
You know, why?
No, they're just going to play Cunningham more.
But, I mean, seriously, let's get Hill at the four. Let's see if he could get that mentality of being more aggressive and really attacking the rim. Like I said, there's no way I'm going to judge him on the offensive end this year unless it's something abysmal, like he's hitting 23% from deep and, you know, he's abysmal there. To me, I'm expecting the defense to be good. I'm expecting the offense to be what it is. I really want to see how much four he could play, and I want to see him be more aggressive on the glass. So that's what I would love from these last two preseason games is just a lot of Hill at four, and let's have him get 6, 7, 8, 10 rebounds a game. That's pretty much it for me. A little bit of Terrence Jones would be nice too, just to see what we got there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Terrence Jones has been injury prone in the past. We should say that. So let's say he's actually hurt and probably won't play any more preseason games because of the injury. Do you think he sticks on this roster, or do you think he's gone?
I think he does, just because I think they're so, you know, when you think you got something for a value, it's much harder to throw it away.
Right.
Like you probably signed Terrence Jones going, I can't believe we got him for the minimum, and you probably signed Alonzo G going, we did this guy a favor.
Yeah.
And same with Lance, we did this guy a favor. So when you think about that mentality, it's much harder to throw away the thing you bought at the garage sale that you thought you got such a bargain on.
All right, I got gonna hit you with a question that I think will be very difficult for you to answer.
The second highest paid player on some Turkish basketball team?
No, though that'd be kind of funny. Anthony Davis does not play against the Denver Nuggets.
Oh.
Who is the Pelicans' leading scorer?
I would go with Tim Frazier.
Okay.
How about you?
I have no idea. I was actually looking at it the other day trying to think, who's going to lead this team in scoring if Davis isn't around? And I'm just staring at it. I'm like, well, it could be Frazier. but Moore could get hot and take that easily. But Buddy Hield could get hot and take that. But Langston Galloway could have a game where he does pretty well. It wouldn't be that shocking if, you know... I just kept going through all the guards.
No Dante?
If Dante Cunningham is the leading scorer, that is a game that will remind me of the last Denver game that I have hated forever. Like, good God, Dante Cunningham.
Yeah.
That means he's already played way too many minutes for the whole season.
That beginning is an interesting stretch, man. I would have loved to seen a healthy Pelicans team take on this initial stretch, because I think, you know, you talk about the Warriors and the Spurs, and you got three of those in the first couple games, but you're not talking about a bunch of other terrifying teams outside of those three, really, to me, until, I think Portland's down for a little bit of a swoon, and Boston has to come here. But, I mean, I don't really see another terrifying game until at the Clippers December 10th. I see a bunch of 50-50 games, again, if this team was fully healthy. And it's just, it's a shame that for a good percentage of that, they could be without three key players, and with the Davis out, possibly four, you know.
So let's be realistic, though. We say three key players. Drew is obviously a real key player. Let's say Tyreke Evans walks in and he slipped away secretly to Germany and had the knee injection therapy that Kobe had like 5 years ago, except it was juiced and miraculous. And he comes back and he can be as good as Tyreke Evans can be, coming off of like no conditioning. So he's now Tyreke Evans, probably playing at 80%, 85% of his peak because he's a little fat and out of shape. Do you think that is a player that is an impact player that would make this team a lot better? Or would you rather just go with the Frazier-Galloway-Moore combination at that spot?
No, I'm not a big Tyreke fan, but I think in this specific situation he is, just because he resets everything to where I don't think Tim Frazier should be a starting NBA guard. So you bring Tyreke in.
Damn you. Maybe, damn you to hell.
Maybe Tyreke is just an average starting point guard, but what that does is it puts Frazier in his right position, and then also, you know, because of now all the guards you have, you're playing probably more three-guard lineups, and now G doesn't have to play, and just by having that an average player, which he would be without the conditioning, just having an average player eating up minutes means that a terrible player like G is not eating up minutes, and it also means that the minutes Frazier is getting, he'll be playing with guys on his level or worse than him rather than guys above him. So, yeah, I really think that something like that would be a big help just because it would reset everything else in its proper place. So I think having any one of those three guys would make a big impact for that reason. The fact that they're all out is just, it's typical of this franchise.
All right. We actually had talked about having a segment where we talked about how depressing it is to root for this franchise, but I'm not going to do that to anybody here. we thought about it. Good God. The injuries is ridiculous. I still remember, like, just being, like, floored when David West had that knee injury against Chicago and was out for the playoffs, and thinking, oh, this team has such horrible injury. Like, I had no idea what was in store for me. No idea.
Yeah. No, it's bad, but yeah, we could have just, but we did discuss some teams that would be worse to root for. That's optimistic way of looking at it. But yeah, it's tough. I guess you could say that maybe that means when the good times come, they'll be that much sweeter. I mean, Saints fans will tell you this, where there was possibly no worse franchise to root for, you know, for a couple of decades. Paper bags over their heads, like, it was embarrassing. And then when they win a Super Bowl, you know, they probably celebrated more than any other single franchise I had seen. The Cleveland Cavs, their city just went through this, so maybe that's the argument you could make where it's not really depressing being a fan of this team because you're just setting yourself up for even sweeter juice down the line.
That's what we'll go with.
And in the next podcast, we'll be talking about the 2017 NBA draft.
All right. So the next podcast, we won't be talking about the 2017 NBA draft. But I do have a quick question for you. Based on where we are injury-wise, do you think it is more or less likely that the Pelicans trade their pick for this upcoming draft?
I think it's getting less and less every day just because of what's out there and what I think it is they need, and what I think they think they need, which I think is wing help, which isn't really out there. So we've already seen / heard that they have no interest in a guy like Rudy Gay.
Yep.
So
yay.
I just can't see that guy becoming available. I don't think they'll give it up for a big. I think they would only give it up for a wing, and I don't think that their pick would be good enough to get the caliber of wing that they want. The only one that might be out there that I wouldn't be absolutely shocked if he became available just because they played so well without him last year, I would be really interested to see what would happen if Damari Carroll became available. And what they would do. I know they think they have a lot of what they could get in Carroll and Solomon Hill, but maybe you double down on it. So I would be curious if he became available, what they would think or do. But that would I'd like to finish off with maybe something optimistic.
Sure.
I still don't believe it until I see it, but we talk about the Pelicans. There's no Pelicans without one thing that you and I weren't very optimistic on 2-3 weeks ago, and it looks like a new CBA is going to get done possibly before the season opens. Are you buying it? What are you expecting? I mean, how big of news is this for people who don't follow that much? What did you think about all this when it came out?
I'm a little bit surprised that the players didn't try to do some sort of counterstroke. But, I mean, if they do that, they've got to be willing to suck up a lot of financial loss. And with all the contracts just signed, I guess if you think about it, that's a lot of financial loss based on how big the money is now. I don't know. I kind of expected them to come back and want to push really hard. And it sounded like from what I heard was they made it a point to say, hey, league, you're going to fund retirement for players who have already retired in the past and healthcare, and that's that's one of their major sticking points is the league funds that. And if I'm the league, if I could avoid a fight for 5% of the revenue or whatever, I'm saying sure. Where can I sign? You know.
Yeah. I'm expecting one of two things to happen. Either one, we hear in a couple of weeks that, oh, they came real close, but then something blew it up. Now they're far apart, and they're going to hold off a couple of months again. I don't believe it. And I understand when people say when there's that much money at stake, just do it and don't risk losing it. I see it the other way, where the more money that's at stake, I've just seen human beings, that's when they get even more greedy, and they fight even more.
Yeah.
The pie's bigger, okay, I want an even bigger piece of a bigger pie.
Benson family, anyone?
Yeah, so I just don't buy it. Or the second one would be that it's essentially a 1 or 2, 3 year deal max, and we're just going to, it's just kicking the can down the line where there'll be very few changes, and that it's basically, okay, neither side will opt out, and we'll just push this forward another year or two and, you know, see how the TV deal.
Yeah, I mean, technically they actually have a CBA through 2020. And the two sides, one of them has to, formally say, we're tearing up our part of this bargain for 2017. So
yeah, that's what I'm guessing is they both just agree to not opt out and have a couple of little tweaks here and there. But just to end off the podcast, one last thing. I mean, if you could get one thing in this new CBA, one change or one addition or, you know, whatever, what is the one thing that you're hoping when it's finalized and we're reading Larry Kuhn's new FAQ, one thing that they've added or done to the CBA that you think would help the Pelicans?
So, I mean, I want to say an amnesty, but A, I don't know if the Bensons would use it, sign off on using it, and B, I don't know if it actually makes a huge difference. It probably does a little bit, but my actual thing is when you take a look at max contracts and players deciding whether they're going to stay or go, does it feel to you like there's a real difference between staying with your team and going to another team? It just feels like toy money at that point. Like when you're talking a max contract, it's like, well, they could stay at home and lock in 5 years for $150 million, or they can go somewhere else and only sign for $120 million for 4 years. But then you're like, but then they can just sign that fifth year probably anywhere else if they're a superstar and get it anyways. It just doesn't feel like it's a real influential amount of money. So if I'm looking at this team and I want Anthony Davis to stay more than anything else, I want to be able to plunk down 20% more than another team over those 4 years. Like, I want it to be a significant, like, if I'm going to go to another city, I am leaving on the table over the same 4 year contract $20 million or something really substantial.
Yeah. Yeah, and this isn't really CBA related. Well, it kind of is. But would it excite you if we heard we were getting two new expansion teams to, let's say, Vegas and Seattle, and that meant New Orleans was heading to the Eastern Conference?
Not anymore.
Yeah. I don't think it's a big difference, and I could see a scenario in which 3 years from now the East is stronger than the West.
Yeah, Joel Embiid is going to carry the Sixers to new heights.
Yeah. No, the one I would like is, let's just get rid of the trade rules. If I want to trade you Rudy Gay and all you have to give me is some $2 million, you know, Dante Cunningham, let's say, and we just want to do a Rudy Gay for Dante Cunningham swap, let's just do it. And all of these trades just seem to happen where, you know, we send all these players and move all these players who have families and kids and all that, and you're just included in the trade because your salary fits.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then all these guys are trade chips because their salary fits and whatever. Let's just, if we want to do a trade, let's just do a trade. And I could understand the reason why you don't want to, like, well, then the Cleveland Cavaliers would just absorb a, you know, a guy with $30 million
Wade.
And give up almost nothing for him. Okay, but really, if the Bulls put Wade on the market, is the best they're going to get nothing? And if so, then that player is probably not a needle mover anyway, you know. So I would just say get rid of all those trades. If a team wants to trade this guy to that team for that, whatever. I just think that would make it so much easier and allow more movement and also not penalize players just because they happen to fit in the contract realm that helps make the trade work. Now that guy gets dumped to another team who doesn't even really want him. I would just get rid of it.
Well, the luxury tax would probably be the penalty that would be applied in that situation.
Exactly.
The thing you need to worry about, though, is like New York just saying, give me all of your good guys who aren't carrying you anywhere. I can basically pay for a roster that's $250 million anyways. And suddenly they can have a 12-man deep team just because they have more money.
Yeah, but I mean, if you put those guys individually out on the market,
Nobody
else is going to offer better than nothing as far as asset-wise.
Yeah, I gotcha.
So I don't think it's something to worry about, you know, as much as, and then, yeah, maybe you increase the tax penalties where if you get into this end of the tax, naturally it's this percentage, but if you do it because of a trade, there's an extra kicker. And like, but I really don't think that's that big of a deal, because if a player is any good at all, you put them on the market, you're going to get offered something for them. And that's what's going to keep them all going to the Knicks. So.
Yeah. Okay. Got anything else to talk about?
No, that's it.
All right. We'll be back in a week. We'll have hopefully two whole games of basketball we could actually watch.
And no injuries.
So I think you're just kind of getting carried away there. Let's keep our expectations low. Thanks for listening to In the Know.
Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G, because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters. The more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.